This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, October 28th, 2011. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, as stimulus funds run out, states move in to cover Medicaid costs, but those in minority groups could be hit hardest by shortfalls. Farmers from Honduras who have been targeted with violence bring their case to Washington. And a same-sex military couple challenges the Defense of Marriage Act in court. We'll speak to one of the lead plaintiffs. That coming up and more right after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Angry protests erupted in Tunisia today in the wake of elections. Hundreds of protesters set fire to police headquarters. Reuters links the protests to dissatisfaction over poor housing conditions and the continued lack of jobs. There's also been tension over the disqualification of some candidates. The newly elected Islamist government blamed the riots on supporters of the old regime. The international community continued to congratulate itself today for its work fostering regime change in Libya. Today, NATO confirmed the end of its mission there. Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen said NATO's military job in Libya is now done and that the operation is concluding in a considered and controlled manner.
Of course, they still have a lot of work to do to build a new Libya based on reconciliation, human rights, and the rule of law. A democratic Libya for all its people.
The mission officially ends next Monday. Syrian security forces today hunted down anti-government protesters after large rallies across the country, leaving as many as 37 people dead. The BBC reports that 170 different protests happened across the country. Many protesters are calling on NATO to establish a no-fly zone over Syria. Wired magazine has learned the Justice Department has not opened an investigation into the injury of Occupy Oakland protester Scott Olson. The 24-year-old Marine veteran suffered a fractured skull Tuesday night when he was hit in the head with a police projectile. Authorities had attempted to clear the Occupy Oakland encampment using tear gas and rubber bullets. This morning, hospital staff upgraded the condition of Olson from critical to fair. Last night in Oakland, hundreds rallied against police brutality and in support of Olson. A solidarity protest for Olson was also held last night in New York City, where this morning authorities raided the city's Occupy encampment. Community News Production Institute reporter Jessel Knorr reports for FSRN.
Just after dawn, dozens of firefighters backed by police swept the Occupy Wall Street encampment. They seized six generators and fuel that were powering lighting and charging electronics. On his radio show today, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg said the materials posed a safety hazard and violated fire code. Mark Bray, a member of Occupy Wall Street's media team, says the movement will not be hampered by the city's actions.
So, you know, it really seems that it's an attempt to try and slow down our occupation, similar to the problems we've been having with tents and with cleaning in the past. So, you know, we're going to come up with new ways to create enough energy for our media team to have lights for our library. We will persevere and we'll be able to get beyond this. It's a momentary setback, but I think we're going to be all right.
This afternoon, protesters are staging an Occupy the Boardroom event and marching on the headquarters of Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, and JP Morgan Chase. Jessel Noor, FSRN, New York.
The East Timor and Indonesian Action Network, or ETAN, is drawing on the energy of the Occupy movements to raise awareness of worker exploitation in West Papua. Today in Phoenix, Arizona, protesters are gathering at the corporate headquarters of mining giant Freeport-McMoRan to speak out against the killings of striking miners in Indonesia. Elizabeth Venable is an organizer with ETAN.
In Arizona, we don't necessarily hear that much about some place like with Papua, but we know that, you know, these corporate headquarters are in our state, our city, and it's our responsibility to hold them accountable.
More than 8,000 workers are currently on strike, protesting low wages. Several miners have been killed by Indonesian police, who ETAN says are paid off by Freeport-McMoRan. Several contract workers brought in by the company as scabs have also been killed. Venable says the situation in the region is messy, involving corrupt police and an ongoing self-determination movement. Organizers say they have been able to generate a lot of interest within the Occupy Phoenix movement. Many in the group are supporting ETAN in their protest. The Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Conference, or APEC, will be coming to Hawaii November 7th through 13th. But already, 2 weeks ahead, activists have begun to spread an anti-corporate message. FSRN's Larry Geller reports from Honolulu.
This week, protesters at the University of Hawaii demanded that the administration pull down large APEC welcome signs scattered around the campus. They say that students and faculty should have been allowed to weigh in on decisions related to APEC support. Demonstrators who appeared outside a pre-APEC agricultural meeting said they were rallying to express that they believe in the globalization of human rights and fundamental freedoms and in the right to maintain a people's culture without the interference of transnational capitalism. Despite repeated assurances by the state government that Honolulu's visible homeless encampments would not be cleared for APEC, local media report that officials removed 60 truckloads of property at one such encampment near the Honolulu airport at a cost of $200,000. Further protests are planned over the coming weeks. It is still unknown how close demonstrators will be allowed to get to the actual meeting venue. Larry Geller, FSRN, Honolulu.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. With stimulus funds expiring, state funding to Medicaid programs is expected to jump by nearly 30% this fiscal year. States could be forced to take money from other places or make cuts to the program, and some say those will hit minority groups the hardest. Michael Lawson has more.
The cost of Medicaid is only expected to increase by about 2% this fiscal year, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. But states will need to find a lot more money to pay for it, as more than $100 billion in federal funds are set to expire. The stimulus package funding helped states to reduce their contributions in 2009 and 2010 as high unemployment caused revenue to dive and Medicaid rolls to swell. Jennifer Burnett with the Council of State Governments says Medicaid is the number one spending item in many states and only comes in second to education in others. While many states have seen a bump in revenue this year, she says states are still struggling.
In most states, tax increases are kind of off the table. Some states are increasing some fees on things to raise some revenue, but in large part, the states are waiting for the economy to improve, essentially, so that they can get back to those pre-recession level revenues.
Nearly every state is instituting a program allowed by the federal government to control Medicaid costs, according to Kaiser. 18 states are reducing or eliminating certain benefits in fiscal year 2012. 14 states will increase or impose new copays. With healthcare costs and Medicaid enrollment high, Burnett says states have few options.
States are looking at the fact that they have a lot of people on Medicaid. They still have increasing costs, but these enhanced rates are going away. So they have to maintain a certain amount of care in their state. And what they're doing largely is cutting provider rates.
California on Thursday was granted permission by the Obama administration to cut nearly $1.5 billion from its program. Rates paid to health providers would be cut by 10%. California has a $27 billion budget gap to fill. Hardest hit could be communities of color. Research conducted by Families USA found Medicaid serves a disproportionately high number of minorities. Half of Black and Latino children nationwide depend on Medicaid for healthcare coverage. 20% of Blacks and Latinos served by Medicaid depend on the program to treat heart disease and stroke. Cindy Hernandez-Cancio is Health Equity Director at Families USA.
What we did find is that, you know, overall there's an enormous proportions of people with these very, very serious life-threatening diseases need Medicaid in order to survive. So cuts in the program would literally mean life and death for them.
Levels of eligibility for the Medicaid program have to be maintained as part of health care reform, restraining states from raising the bar. All 29 Republican governors have written to the White House and Congress seeking a reprieve from this requirement. Many more people will be covered by Medicaid in 2014 under health care reform, with the federal government picking up 100% of the additional cost. Cancio says the requirement is necessary to avoid even greater trouble down the road.
If 3 years from now we're going to be expanding it, it was really important that we don't undermine it in the run-up to that, because it would be really, really, really difficult for states to be able to meet that.
Democratic members of the California congressional delegation are speaking out against the cuts in their state. The Supreme Court will decide in the spring if patients and doctors can sue over reductions in Medicaid payments. Michael Lawson, FSRN, Washington.
With Don't Ask, Don't Tell now officially a policy of the past, same-sex couples in the military are turning their attention to a federal law that they say denies them key benefits and relegates them to second-class citizens in the armed forces. On Thursday, the Service Members Legal Defense Network filed a federal lawsuit to challenge the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act. The 1996 law, known as DOMA, bars federal recognition of same-sex marriages performed in states that allow them. The challenge sets up a legal battle over specific benefits now denied to same-sex couples, such as medical benefits, basic housing allowances, visitation rights in hospitals, and more. We're joined now by Casey McLaughlin. Her wife, Shannon McLaughlin, is a lead plaintiff in the suit and a major in the Massachusetts Army National Guard. Casey McLaughlin, welcome to FSRN.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with how things stand right now. What benefits are denied to you and Shannon at this point, and how does that affect your lives?
Some of the most major benefit is health care. Right now, I do not have health insurance under the plan, even though we pay for a family plan. Shannon and I have two infant twins. They're 10 months old, and when they were born, I resigned from my position as a public school teacher. I teach high school history. And with that, I lost my benefits. And in the state of Massachusetts, health care is mandated. And so we had to now pay $700 a month for COBRA, even though Shannon has a family plan through the military that includes the family. And so I shouldn't have to pay this extra money because no heterosexual couple who is in the military would have to do the same. But the principle of it is at issue here. I am a spouse. I am legally married to Shannon, and it's the law. And because of DOMA, again, this is, it sounds like an attack on the military, and it's not. I cannot emphasize enough that Shannon absolutely loves the military. It's been a calling for her since she was 17 years old, and she loves her job and loves everybody that she works with. This is not a lawsuit against the United States military. This is about the Defense of Marriage Act, which ties the hands of the military and prevents them from extending these same benefits because of the way the law is written, prohibiting federal recognition of same-sex spouses. And that's what this comes down to.
Well, tell us a little more about your wife, Shannon. You said that, you know, since she was a teenager that she's had this affinity for service, for her country, and in the armed services. How long has she served in the National Guard in Massachusetts?
She has been in for 13 years and was first enlisted, was deployed to Iraq after the after 9/11. And was deployed to a number of areas. It was Kuwait and Operation Enduring Freedom. And it's always been a passion for her. Public service is a passion. And as it is for me, I'm a teacher. And so it was a pretty big decision. Our life is definitely going to change. And, you know, we're down to one income. And so to put her job at risk is it's no joke.
You do have two very young children, and you describe this decision of entering into this lawsuit as a difficult one because of certain consequences. How did having your children factor into that decision?
Well, we want to raise our kids with certain standards, certain morals. And even though this is a difficult decision, it's the right thing to do. I hope that they grow up adhering to the principles and beliefs that they personally believe in. And even though it's difficult to do the right thing, I really hope that and have optimism that the constitutionality of what marriage is extends to to same-sex couples as well, because our families are as valid. We don't want special treatment. We just want equal treatment. And these are service members that we're talking about right now. And of all people, shouldn't they be the ones who are entitled to the benefits that they work so hard for? I really think it's a no-brainer, honestly.
Casey McLaughlin's wife, Shannon, is a Massachusetts Army National Guard major. The couple are lead plaintiffs in a lawsuit challenging the Defense of Marriage Act. Casey McLaughlin, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
FSRN will hold its 2011 annual meeting on Sunday, October 30th at 9:30 a.m. Pacific and 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time. This meeting will be via teleconference. You can attend by dialing 218-486-1611. The code is annual pound sign. That number again is 218-486-1611, and the code is annual, that's A-N-N-U-A-L, and then press the pound sign. For more information, visit fsrn.org. Ongoing land conflicts in the Bajo Aguan region of Honduras have killed 42 campesinos and displaced hundreds more since the coup in January 2009. New cables released by WikiLeaks reveal that the U.S. has supported the wealthy businessman accused of financing the violence, despite evidence that he traffics cocaine. This week, representatives from the Aguan brought their case before the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights at the Organization of American States in Washington, D.C. Alice Olstein reports.
Rudy Hernandez of the Unified Campesino Movement of the Aguan traveled from Honduras to testify before the commission about the human rights crisis in his community.
Después del golpe de Estado del 2009,
they've unleashed a system of persecution on every one of us, including constant surveillance, both physical and electronic. Our telephones are tapped, our emails too, and we're followed. All this just for defending the right to life, health care, education, and land, because the people of the Bajo Aguan don't enjoy these rights.
Hernandez hopes the commission will pressure the Honduran government to investigate and prosecute the crimes in the Bajo Aguan.
Violence has increased and impunity is perfect.
That's Martin Wolpold-Bosian of the human rights group FIAN International. He has spent years documenting the human rights abuses in the Aguan and petitioning the government to intervene.
There is no investigation. The state does not even recognize that there are 42 peasants killed. They say there are 23 peasants killed during the last 2 years. We have the list of the dead peasants with the name, with the place. We want to know from the government of Honduras which of these peasants were not killed.
The struggle in the Bajo Aguan dates back to the early 90s, when the right-wing elite of Honduras started to roll back the agrarian reforms of the 70s. Corporations purchased and often stole the land owned by campesino cooperatives, and no one benefited more than biofuels magnate Miguel Facuse, who now owns thousands of hectares in the region. When campesino rights organizations tried to retake their land in 2009, they suffered brutal repression at the hands of Honduran police, the military, and Facuse's private forces. A 2011 fact-finding mission by several international human rights groups cites Facuse's uniformed security guards as the primary actors in the conflict. The U.S. State Department has known since 2004 that Facuse is likely connected to cocaine trafficking, but has since met with him twice, according to U.S. Embassy cables released by WikiLeaks. Journalist and professor Dana Frank has been investigating the U.S. government's relationship with Facuse.
The U.S. is using drug money, supposedly fighting the drug war in Central America, to support a known drug trafficker's war against campesinos.
Frank says the military and paramilitary forces in the region, including Facuse's hired guns, receive U.S. tax dollars through the Central American Regional Security Initiative. The stated goal of the $165 million program is combating narco trafficking, organized crime, and corruption. Frank says the Aguan repression is even more concerning when viewed in its larger political context.
you know, it looks like Honduras is just this little bitty country, and why should we care? But actually, it's the first domino in the United States pushing back against all the democratically elected center-left and left governments that came to power in Latin America, in Venezuela, in Bolivia, and in Ecuador in the last 20 years. And the U.S. is threatened by that because they're challenging U.S. economic and political and military domination of Latin America.
In May, 87 members of Congress wrote to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton asking her to suspend aid to Honduras's police and military until the human rights situation improves. Yet support for the Lobo regime, both financial and diplomatic, continues. Just last month, President Obama received Honduran President Porfirio Lobo at the White House.
President Lobo's leadership is responsible not only for helping to restore constitutional order and democracy, and commitment to fair and free elections, but it's also allowed Honduras once again to rejoin the Organization of American States.
But to Hernandez, the situation on the ground looks very different.
Since the coup, the institutions of the country have been broken. The state doesn't have the capacity to follow through with its promises to protect the rights of the citizens of the Bajo Aguan and the rest of the country.
The homicide rate of Honduras is now the highest in the world, according to a UN study released earlier this month, and the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights has not investigated Honduras's crisis since sending a delegation in the wake of the 2009 coup. But Hernandez hopes that after hearing his testimony, the commission will issue a resolution supporting his community's struggle, or at least return to the region to observe the situation for themselves. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
The Republican National Convention is still 10 months away, but officials in Florida already are preparing security for the high-profile event. The city of Tampa plans to spend $55 million on everything from high-tech surveillance cameras to police equipment and weaponry. The city also wanted to use unmanned drones, but as FSRN's Josh Holton reports, police are backing away from that proposal.
The drones the police had been considering are smaller than Predator aircraft used by the U.S. in the skies over Pakistan and Yemen. Assistant Chief of Police Mark Hamlin said the Tampa Police Department said these drones would have been small enough to hold in your hand.
I can tell you this. Aviation is a very expensive part of the police budget. Our job is keeping this city safe. I think we owe it to the public to explore a way of doing that more efficiently and effectively, especially if it saves money. However, I don't think the drones that we were actually put in the request for proposal for the camera system were the type we need to look at.
Hamlin said that while keeping a tight budget is important, there were other reasons for dropping the drones.
A couple of other things came into play. Would there be federal aviation restrictions that the FAA could have? And also, the ones that we're looking at only flew for 20 minutes. Was that efficient enough? Because sometimes when you get a helicopter up on an active crime scene, they could be up there for hours. So it might not have been efficient. But I think in the future, these are things that all municipalities need to explore that have expensive aviation units.
But even without drones patrolling the skies, Hamlin said there will be plenty of other plans for aerial security.
We've also got some loose commitments from some federal agencies that might provide air support as well, like the Coast Guard, Federal Bureau of Investigation, Customs and Border Patrol. So I think we're going to be set with enough aviation support.
At past political conventions, there have been hundreds of arrests, and many protesters have won monetary settlements. Tampa Mayor Bob Buckhorn said he is committed to protecting free speech, but last month he promised to take a hard line against what he called anarchists.
What I will not tolerate is somebody who chooses to break the law. We will have zero tolerance for that, and we will be brutally efficient in exercising our responsibilities to make sure that those visitors and those conventioners and everyone else is safe, including the safety of my officers.
Both the mayor and the police department have made clear that no illegal activity will be allowed and that police will arrest people for committing even a minor crime. One group, Food Not Bombs, plans to engage in civil disobedience by feeding RNC protesters in the days leading up to the convention. But local police have shut down Food Not Bombs in Tampa and Orlando for doing just that. Food Not Bombs co-founder Keith McHenry said they plan to violate what he calls unjust public feeding requirements and to sue the city before the convention for an injunction against feeding prohibitions.
Food Not Bombs has not been intimidated by the authorities in any country. and we're not likely to be intimidated by the authorities in Tampa and St. Petersburg. And we're going to continue to protect our constitutional rights to provide free food and to organize to end the militarization of our society and to start diverting funding away from things like the arms race and instead put it towards things that would create real security like food, education, health care, and the things that Americans really need.
Back in July, Assistant Police Chief Hamlin told WMNF that police will be fully equipped to suppress any violent or illegal activity.
We're prepared for a civil unrest situation. We train for that. We have equipment for that. We have certain weapons for that, and we have chemicals for that.
More recently, Hamlin clarified the arsenal would include beanbag guns, tear gas, and pepper spray. He said innovative technology such as deafening sonic cannons or the heat ray called the active denial system could be considered. There are pending proposals for security cameras, some of which can read license plates at speeds of 100 miles per hour. Josh Holton, FSRN, Tampa.
As Occupy events and encampments enter their seventh week, today we end with a familiar voice who recently made a stop at Occupy Boston.
If the bonds and associations that are being established in these remarkable events can be sustained through a long, hard period ahead, because victories don't come quickly, it could turn out to be a very significant moment in American history.
Linguist and philosopher Noam Chomsky called the Occupy movement spectacular and unprecedented and suggested they exert pressure on elected officials in Congress.
The big topic in Washington everyone concentrates on is the deficit. For the public, correctly, the deficit is not regarded as much of an issue, and it isn't really much of an issue. The issue is joblessness, not a deficit. Now, there's a deficit commission, but there's no joblessness commission. As far as the deficit is concerned, the public has opinions. Take a look at the polls. Overwhelmingly support higher taxes on the wealthy and preserve the limited social benefits.
Chomsky also urged the audience to pay attention to two issues that threaten this planet's survival, nuclear war and environmental catastrophe. He said if the Occupy movement continues to grow and becomes a major force, there is some hope for the future. That does it for today's newscast. The program was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Michael Lawson. And thanks to Chuck Rosina for providing sound. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Jane Chang and Janine Etter. And a special thanks to Jane Chang. Her last day at the tech board is today. We wish her well and thank her for her work with FSRN and showing such skill and grace under deadline pressure. FSRN is largely funded by listeners like you. More information is available on our website at fsrn.org. We always welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening today. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.